Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, local family physician and your host for an hour of medical news, science and healthcare in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your emails and your phone calls here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, there was some really interesting stuff in the news, and rather than doing a retrospective at the beginning of the new year, I thought we'd take a moment and look forward at some of the recent data that's been coming out, particularly a bit of research on Parkinson's disease. There's a technology called optical coherence tomography. It's basically bouncing light off the back of the retina and then measuring how that light is changed in the bounce. Believe it or not, using sophisticated mathematical analysis, they can actually measure the thickness of the retina and take a look at the inner retinal layer. For example, in a person with glaucoma, because the increased pressure in the back of the eyeball pushes on the nerve and can damage it, you can monitor and see if that damage is occurring. Well, it turns out that there are other diseases that have a signature on the retina. After all, as they taught me in medical school, the retina is actually part of the central nervous system. And surprisingly enough, that means that you can measure things that are going on in other parts of the brain. For example, OCT technology apparently has a signature for Alzheimer's disease. People with Alzheimer's tend to have thinning of the superior part of their retina. No one knows why, but it's a fairly consistent change. Unfortunately, it occurs late in Alzheimer's disease after the disease has already manifested, so it's not a particularly useful finding. However, Parkinson's disease, in its very, very early stages, when it may not even be apparent, actually shows thinning of the retina. So if we can use retinal thinning using this OCT technology, which is widely available, I know that there are several centers in our community, for example, here in Santa Cruz who have that. The idea of being able to use this as a diagnostic test and identify people who are at higher risk for Parkinson's, perhaps starting them on anti-inflammatory therapy, perhaps using some of the early interventions like high-dose CoQ10. If I had a family history of Parkinson's and a thin retina, I'd probably be taking 1,200 milligrams of CoQ10 to prevent further progression of the disease. It's been shown that it works, but it works when you get to it early. And getting to disease like Parkinson's early, before it gathers much momentum, is, of course, the difficult detail. I want to follow up on some call from last week talking about something that had been going around on the internet about calcium in milk actually lowering the calcium in your body. And in researching that, I came across a really excellent review article that I want to share with you. I'll post the link on the website, but it comes from the Harvard School of Public Health, and it has a subsegment called The Nutrition Source. And like I said, I'll post the link. Really excellent and well-referenced discussion of calcium, milk, osteoporosis, and treatment, and some very, very interesting little tidbits that came out. But to speak to the particular question of the caller, no, there really isn't much in the way of solid data that shows that milk or dairy products lower calcium in your bones. I think that's probably based on a misinterpretation of some data. In any event, there is good data about the amount of calcium that's needed. And a couple of important things to understand, though, it's not just getting the calcium into your mouth. It also has to get into your bones. And there are a number of other very important factors that influence that. One of those factors is the influence of vitamin D. Now, vitamin D comes from sunlight. You can also take supplements that contain vitamin D. And vitamin D is key for getting the calcium from the intestines into the bloodstream. Without adequate vitamin D levels, you can load all the calcium you want in, but you aren't going to absorb it. So this is a very important factor. And unfortunately, in our fight to prevent skin cancer, we've encouraged the use of sunscreen to the exclusion of healthy vitamin D. People who live in the northern hemispheres, particularly dark skin, people who live above a latitude of 40 are often frequently vitamin D deficient. I strongly urge anyone who lives above latitude 37, who has darker skin, whether they're African American or just darker skinned, blended racially, get a vitamin D test, 25 hydroxy vitamin D, in January or February and see how low it is. This is a really important thing, and it may account for why people in India, Japan, and Peru, where the calcium intake is very low, but the vitamin D intake is very high, show lower rates of osteoporosis than in the United States, where the average calcium intake is much higher, but the average vitamin D level in the blood is much lower. Another important dietary factor is vitamin K. Vitamin K is very influential in what the body does with calcium regulation. Most of our calcium is actually in our bones, and keeping it there seems to be important for vitamin K. So we're looking for at least 110 micrograms of vitamin K. Part of the Women's Nurses Health Study showed that women who get that much are 30% less likely to break a hip. What'll get you that much vitamin K? One serving of green leafy vegetables a day, and that cut the risk of hip fracture in half in the nurse's study, so a significant factor with vitamin K. So really, what it boils down to is that calcium in milk and dairy products is highly accessible, highly bioavailable, and the vegetarian sources of calcium, which include greens, peas, trail mix, beans, and believe it or not, iceberg lettuce, are all decent sources of calcium. The problem is eating enough of these things. It would take 8 heads of iceberg lettuce a day to get enough calcium. But really what it amounts to is a diet rich in vegetables will probably supply enough calcium, especially if you throw in some almonds or walnuts. Get your sun or take vitamin D supplements, and you'll already be getting the vitamin K from the leafy greens. Weight-bearing exercise, and that means anything but swimming. Swimming, unfortunately, is not weight-bearing. So I hope that helps. And we have a correction from a caller, an alert listener. I said the sun was a source of vitamin D, which is incorrect. It simply activates its synthesis. Very good. Thank you, caller, for keeping me on the straight and narrow there. More good news that just came out before we go to the phones. The best study so far, a 3-year post study in Pueblo, Colorado, after they enacted a smoking ban in the workplace, showed an amazing 41% decrease in the number of hospitalized cases of heart attack. There have been earlier studies looking at smoking bans, but this is the first one to last for 3 years. Think of secondhand smoke and indoor smoke as a trigger. You have to already have atherosclerosis. You have to already have the plaque in your arteries. But the plaque doesn't have to rupture, and your blood doesn't have to clot on that rupture. Where secondhand smoking seems to come into effect, and what this data implies, is that it's an irritant to the bloodstream. It increases coagulation. And if your clot should crack open, it's just the amount of difference between whether or not you have a heart attack or not, whether that clot is able to form in the blood vessel. This is what the aspirin a day does, and this is something that the secondhand smoke fights. So just to give you some round numbers, in Pueblo, Colorado, 3 years after the smoking in public buildings ban, the number of heart attacks went from 257 per 100,000 to 152 per 100,000, a drop of 100. That's more than 40%. That's a really statistically significant ban. And it could be that a lot of people quit smoking. That's fine with me. It doesn't all have to be secondhand smoke. It may have gotten just too annoying if you couldn't smoke inside in Colorado, where I imagine it gets pretty cold in the winter. Anything that reduces the amount of smoking, whether it's active or passive tobacco exposure, clearly makes a significant difference in heart attacks. And, you know, as we move into a national healthcare system, God willing, as we move into a national healthcare system, your secondhand smoke or your primary smoke is my tax dollars at work. So I'm going to have a thing or two to say about it. Let's go to Barbara in line 2. Hello, Barbara in Scotts Valley. You're on the air.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
It's been years since I've talked to you. I used to listen to you on K KSCO.
Oh, my God, that is years ago.
And I also have seen you over the years. I'm now 80 years old. Yuck. Anyway, I'm doing well, but what I want to know is we are going to Belize, and it's recommended by the Lonely Planet Belize book, just out, the new one, to have updates on all your shots.
Yeah. Belize is kind of on the exotic side.
Well, it is, and we're going to be on a small boat, and we will be going to the Jaguar Preserve and other places.
Oh, well, that sounds wonderful.
Well, it does.
And you're 80. I'm just loving that, you know.
I'm telling you, too, because I remember when you went down to South America, and I came back from Bolivia and had some problems.
Oh, yeah.
So we've had all these shots. Mainly, I want to know, are these shots available, these updates, at the clinic, or do we have to go to a special place?
Well, the most important shots for that part would be your tetanus. Polio is not really an issue in South America, thank goodness.
Well, actually, this is Central America.
Nevertheless, same.
Yeah, yeah. Same
yeah.
Old thing.
Yeah. No, we worry about that only in Southeast Asia now.
Right. Oh, gosh.
So that's still a problem there. But anyway, we're not worrying about polio. You do want to make sure your tetanus is up to date.
That has to be updated because last time I had that was when I had to go through rabies.
Right. Influenza. I hope you've had a Pneumovax shot after the age of 65.
Is that lifetime or does that have to be boosted?
Oh, you know, the recommendations are after 65, you only have to do it once. And I think that's based on the idea that by 85, you'll be dead. So,
well, shame on them.
Yeah, I know. And clearly not the appropriate expectation. You want to assume that people will still be alive at 100 and work from there. But anyway, we tell people if you get vaccinated before, like it's 55, that do it in 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
Do a booster.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of data to back that up. That's a real seat of the pants recommendation.
Yeah.
I think that I would probably want you to get another vaccination at 85 just on general principle.
Yeah, I plan on being here at 85 too.
I expect you will be. Now, in terms of other vaccinations, cholera, which is an issue down there.
Now, see, they don't mention that here.
Yeah, well, I'm not thrilled with the cholera vaccine because it's only about 50% effective, but I thought they might mention it in the book.
Well, they mentioned chickenpox, hepatitis A, B, measles, tetanus, diphtheria, typhoid, and yellow fever.
Okay. There is an adult pertussis vaccine now, which is called Adacel, and that might be worth getting as well. That'd be your tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, but there's an adult version you can use. Measles, mumps, and rubella. You're at the age where you probably had all of these diseases as a child.
Yeah.
And actually, childhood disease is a better form of vaccination.
I understand that, yes.
And it lasts your entire life. So as long as you have a clinical history of those things, you don't need those vaccines.
Well, what was interesting was you gave me chickenpox vaccine when I was going to one of the South America countries about 15 years ago because I didn't know whether I'd ever had it.
Uh-huh.
I think it was a double shot.
Right, you're good then.
And then I got a mild case of,
shingles.
So you said at the time, or maybe it was one of the other doctors, said, well, then you did have chickenpox as a child.
Yep, that's right.
So I had those shots for nothing, but at the time, what about hepatitis A?
It's a poop-to-mouth disease, and I pretty much, anybody who leaves the United States, particularly for anything resembling a developing nation, should have Hep A. I actually think it's a decent thing to have here if you plan to eat out.
I understand that in this book, this Lonely Planet is a guide that is designed really for people who are going on their own, might be staying with local people.
Yes.
And all that.
Yeah. But I do think that getting hepatitis A vaccines is a great idea. All it takes is one kitchen worker. And you're sunk. You know, you're going to have a real challenge to your liver. And the older you are, the harder it is to back off from an illness, no matter how healthy and active you are.
Tell me about it.
You know, it's that use-by date. Some of your cells have reached their use-by date.
On them.
I know. Well, all we need is to figure out how to extend the telomeres without giving you cancer, and we'll all be looking at 150-year lifespan.
Well, we'll be on a small boat, and most of the time, we will be going to a couple of Honduran islands, and we'll be going into Guatemala. There's a little orphanage there. We've been with this company many times.
Is this a dive trip, too?
It could be dive, but
if you're going to snorkel, you need the Hep A.
Yep.
Because
your base will be in the water.
You're basically in poop. Very dilute. But the runoff from those villages?
Well, you know, the same thing is here with these surfers that are surfing locally.
Oh, yeah.
They don't seem to worry about that, do they?
Well, if their doctor knows they're surfing locally, hopefully their doctor is pushing them to get Hep A.
Now, it says here that I need a dose before trip with booster 6 to 12 months later. Now, would that be if you had never had this before?
For hepatitis A, if you want lifelong immunity, you have to do two shots.
Okay, well, we've got all our yellow paper.
Yeah, your first shot will cover you for the trip.
Okay.
And then since I don't think this is going to be your last adventure travel thing, get the second shot 6 to 12 months later.
Okay. And I, this is all available at the medical clinic?
Oh, at our clinic, yeah. Yeah, and then there's typhoid, which is another poop-to-mouth disease, and there's two types of vaccines. There's a shot, and there's an oral typhoid vaccine.
There's more capsules by mouth.
Right, and that's the better one because it lasts about 5 years as opposed to 3 years for the shot. The only problem with the typhoid orally is timing. You can't be taking any antibiotics, and you can't be taking any anti-malarials because they'll mess up the effectiveness of the vaccine. So you have to...
Now, let's see. We are leaving 4 weeks from yesterday, so I know this has to be done at least 2 weeks before. Sooner the better.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we will need chloroquine for malaria, too.
Yep.
And that's, I know we always take 2 weeks. You start 2 weeks before, 1 week apart, and then you continue, I think, 4 weeks after. That's still the recommended?
For chloroquine, well, you know, I usually will have people take it 1 week before just to make sure that they don't have an adverse effect.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then you have a chance to change plans, like switch them to doxycycline if they do. And then the 4 weeks after, for a month afterwards, that's the key.
Yes, I know. Certainly is. I've seen some horror pictures.
Yeah, and it doesn't keep you from getting malaria. You still get the malaria, but the malaria parasite doesn't have a chance to integrate itself into your body.
Yep.
So it sort of washes through you and bounces through, but it doesn't make you sick.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, I will be calling Monday morning and making an appointment.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Aline in Santa Cruz. Hello, Aline, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was curious. I had a friend who was using suntanning beds, and she said that they told her that she can get some vitamin D from using a suntan bed.
It's true.
So I wonder if you've heard of any kind of a safe amount, because I'm not too sure that those beds are safe to the skin cancer kind of a concern.
Right. Well, you've got the skin cancer and you've got the aging. So... with respect to the tanning beds, the dose for vitamin D is called a minimal erythematous dose twice a week. And what does that mean, minimal erythematous dose? It's the little flush that you get when you've been in the sun and your skin is a little pink and warm, but you don't burn. You don't develop a sunburn the next day. So it's sort of a short-term flush and maybe increased sensation of the skin, and it's pink, and if you push on it with your finger, you'll get a blanching, and then, you know, 1-1002, and the color comes back. And if it goes to a burn, and you're actually sore the next day, that was too much.
Or itching.
Exactly, that's too much. So the trick, of course, varies with a person's sun sensitivity and their natural melanin content.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, with a tanning bed, you start off underdosing and work your way up. You definitely don't want to jump right in with both feet and go 15 minutes at full, because you will give yourself a sunburn if you haven't been in the sun for a while.
Well, she was saying they equated 15 minutes to like 4 hours of sun, and I would never be in the sun for 4 hours with my skin, but I imagine maybe 5 minutes, 8 minutes might be an interesting place to start.
Exactly. I would go 3 to 5 minutes and then look for that flush, which should develop within an hour. That's your indicator that you got enough UVA deep enough to create an inflammatory response.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your key. If you created that inflammatory response, then enough rays have penetrated to trigger the transition of the cholecalciferol into the 25-hydroxycholecalciferol, which then goes to the kidney where it gets converted. And it's like, oh my God, it's complicated.
Wow. Yeah, great. And another comment about vitamin D or any kind of a supplement. Years ago, between age 14 and 24, I was given cortisone shots or steroid shots in the sinuses for inflammation. And I guess I found out later on I was allergic to dairy, but I just kept getting a stuffed nose and I could hardly breathe. And he said I had hay fever. But 2 to 3 times a year, I would receive 3 shots on each once a week for 3 weeks.
Worked great, didn't it?
For a while.
Yeah.
And then it stopped. But then in my early 30s, I got in a car accident, and the chiropractor said that my pelvis had striations, which were signs of advanced osteoporosis.
Have you had a bone scan? X-rays aren't that reliable.
Oh, really? Because he showed me they look like little windows of light in my bone.
Nevertheless, I would get the actual density monitored.
Yeah, I did later, down about 9 months later, because what I did was find a supplement, and he had told me that there's this, I may be saying this wrong, but it's called microcrystalline hydroxyapatite,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which is supposed to be the most absorbable form of calcium. And
right.
It actually comes from cow bones.
Right, it's a ground-up bone.
Yeah, and the supplement that I found was with Jarrow Company. It's called Bone Up.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that product.
Oh, yeah, because it has everything, C, D, K, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. K, and, of course, magnesium, zinc, copper, manganese.
Yeah, the other two things are boron and strontium.
Which, yeah, it has boron. Oh, strontium.
Hmm. It may not have the strontium. That's usually not in those. But I don't remember the exact bone-up formula.
Yeah, I have it here in front of me. It doesn't have strontium. It does have the boron.
We usually just use strontium in people who have already got osteoporosis. You said you'd had a density scan, though?
That, yeah, I did later on.
How was it?
It was good. They said it was pretty healthy for my time, and I understood that before I even got the bone density scan, you know, because I took his word for what was going on with my body, and mm-hmm. of course 10 years of cortisone could possibly break your bone density down, I imagine.
Yes, especially when you're doing it in childhood. The other thing that is it could leave artifacts in the bone that might mimic osteoporosis.
Oh,
because the growth is going to be episodic. Because the cortisone shot also reduces the growth rate of bone and causes premature closing of the epiphysis. In other words, you could have a kind of zigzaggy growth pattern that would not be typical and would look weird.
Yeah, this what I remember seeing on those x-rays were these like thin, long lines like
right.
going from the right to the left and like open like little windows.
Yeah, and I've seen that in people who don't have osteoporosis.
Huh.
So that may have been true or may have been a misinterpretation.
Right.
And we don't use the x-rays because they're very unreliable.
Right. Wow. Okay. And, well, I took the bone up anyways.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was a really great product.
Nothing wrong with it. And it may have done you a great deal of good. It doesn't hurt. And it might have helped you a lot. Right now, you've got normal bone density and you're how old?
46.
All right. So what you're going to do now is eat your greens and walk. Jump rope, do some kind of weight-bearing exercise every day.
Uh-huh.
Just even 40 jumping jacks. There was a study in England, I always love to quote it, because it was in a nursing home, and they had all these little old ladies doing jump ropes and jumping 40 times a day, and it cut down on falls, and it increased their bone density.
Wow, that's good news. Speaking of falls, I did have one more question.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I fell getting out of a hot tub, unfortunately. I guess I was too relaxed, and the ground was very wet. And it was rock, unfortunately. I hit my head pretty badly. I was sick throughout the day, and for several days, my digestion was messed up. But what was strange is there was this pain underneath the left side, kind of like where it might feel like where the stomach is, the esophagus and the stomach are meeting or slightly below that, you know, mm-hmm. in my, what do you call this, your solar plexus area, but more to the left.
Yeah.
Slightly under the rib. And here I am over 2 years later. This pain is still present. There was a time it actually felt like something was moving up into my chest, pressing against my lungs, like making it hard to breathe. This
right.
was a whole weekend long it did this, and I should have gone to the hospital then because it has never been that yeah. exciting since. But it does affect my digestion still. It's like my digestion was great before that, and now if I get a little nervous or something, it just kind of gets a little out of control and messes up my digestion.
I wonder if you actually tore your esophageal hiatus, the place in the diaphragm.
Mm-hmm.
The diaphragm muscle fibers are kind of woven together, almost basket weavy.
Yeah.
And the esophagus goes through it like you stuck your finger through a loosely woven basket.
Yeah.
And that opening can enlarge. And if I can imagine a trauma, which suddenly increased your abdominal pressure,
mm-hmm.
potentially pushing your stomach up into that hiatus and spreading it a little bit.
Right.
So that sounds so much like what we call a sliding hiatal hernia.
Right, and that's actually, I was just from my own intuition with my body, it felt like that's what happened because I do know some anatomy, and I thought, you know, it just seems like it stretched that point.
Yeah, and it could have done, and it wouldn't necessarily come back. Have you ever been checked for that? There are ways of looking for that.
Yeah, a couple times I drank the barium and we did, you know, but unfortunately I should have gone that weekend when it was really reaching up high and I was just thinking it'd just go away because it was kind of scary and it was Labor Day weekend. I'm like, bad weekend to be having an emergency. But
How badly does it bother you now? I mean, is it really getting in your way?
It's like I could go weeks without it bothering me, but there are some tense things happening in my life from a lot of different angles, with parents or, you know,
sure.
the economy, who knows, all these different things that are happening. And when I get a little nervous, it actually disrupts my sleep, like it'll wake me up, and then my digestion gets messed up, so I don't know if I'm really digesting my food well as well. You know, I'd like to be getting healthy by eating instead of getting kind of sick feeling and nauseous.
Exactly.
Well, I just wonder in the long run what could happen.
Well, not much unless, and the unless would be you're really dumping a lot of acid up into the esophagus or a lot of bile up into the esophagus.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing that, an endoscopy should reveal it. So a less invasive thing that would give you a clue would be pH monitoring. So at a time when you're under a lot of stress, you could wear a gastric pH monitor. And this is a device that electrically, it's a little tiny tube, goes down your nose, goes into the upper part of the esophagus, and you basically walk around with tape on your face for a couple of days. And when you digest food, if the esophageal sphincter is intact, there'll be like a little belch of acid, but not much. But if the pH is staying at 4 or 4.5 in your lower esophagus, then that tells us that there's a problem with the seal. And it's not so much the hiatal hernia as the seal. If you've got a hiatal hernia and the esophageal sphincter is good, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But if your esophageal sphincter is poor and you don't have a hiatal hernia, I care because you are at increased risk for cancer of the esophagus. Although
right.
I want to caution that's rare and there are better things than going on lifelong Prilosec for it.
Yeah.
And particularly when you have an interest in digesting your food. Nevertheless, there are surgical solutions. And if you have a symptomatic hiatal hernia, you can get a fundoplication done laparoscopically. And there's some newer things where they inject collagen around the sphincter to kind of beef it up a little bit and improve the seal.
Right.
And then there's radioablation, which is still experimental, where you kind of tighten things up and you might be the candidate for that. But bottom line, I think, is pH monitoring. Because if this is just nervous stomach and your emotions are expressing themselves in your intestine, you want to go see an acupuncturist.
Well, actually, this never happened before in my digestion. I've certainly been through...
But you've never been 42 before.
Yeah, 46. But the thing is my digestion, I mean, I've had extreme stress in many different points of my life, and mm-hmm. It's never affected my digestion until my fall.
Right, and I agree with you that there could be a connection. I'm just saying it may not be dangerous. It may be a live with it kind of thing.
Right, and it does cause
not,
belching,
yeah,
too.
And if it's not dangerous.
It's comforting.
Yeah, exactly. I think you blew your seal and maybe have a hiatal hernia. The question is it broke enough to fix surgically, or is it a live-with-it thing? And I would tend to use, am I damaging my esophagus as my tiebreaker on that? But you may decide that you want to have the surgery just for symptomatic management. And believe me, if you have health insurance, I'm sure you can find someone who will do the surgery for you for symptomatic management.
Huh, that's interesting. I've actually had to go to a couple different doctors because my first doctor thought there was nothing wrong with me. And
well,
I was having like the episode and she was just saying it's all okay. And that would have been the time to do testing, I imagine.
Right. Well, mistranslation, it's all okay means this is not going to kill you. And you're saying, but I want you to fix it.
Right, I do, because in the long run, like you say, I know that the esophagus can't handle a lot of the acid washing up on it over a length of time.
Well, it can take quite a bit, actually. It's designed to. The question is, are you doing damage? And a pH monitor would tell you that.
Is there something natural that I can kind of consume to kind of soothe the esophagus itself?
Yeah, there is. You want to do humectants. Let me think. I'm trying to dredge up. Marshmallow is one. There's some herbal things that kind of coat the esophagus and the stomach. I know that there's a number of products. Marshmallow is one of them, and I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank on the others.
I know when you cook flaxseed, it gets kind of viscous. It kind of sticks to stuff. Would that be a good...
I don't know. I don't know. That one's not ringing a bell. But
or
I know,
slippery elm, maybe?
Go to the health food store and look for something that's designed to alleviate heartburn that contains marshmallow.
Okay.
Okay, and that's an actual plant. It's not the marshmallows that we toast.
Right.
And they'll probably be the other herbs whose names I'm blanking on in that mixture.
Great.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I want to announce something. I got this from Judith in Ben Lomond, who wants us to know about an Obama transitional team project hosted and moderated by local volunteers. This is a community forum to get your input and ideas on ways to improve healthcare for our elders. As you may know, if you listen regularly to this program, Tom Daschle, who is going to be spearheading the healthcare reform movement in the Obama administration, has requested that we all get together and brainstorm, boil our ideas down, and send them to the government. My God, I can't remember in my lifetime when my government has actually asked me for suggestions on how to be governed. So I think we should all be participating in this. This will take place Saturday, January 10th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. at the Senior Center in Highlands Park on Highway 9, 8500 Highway 9. And the information line, 336-4232. I'll repeat that, 336-4232. And if you didn't get that, I will post that on the Ask Dr. Don website. But I would certainly encourage you to give it a thought and maybe do the actual due diligence of showing up and contributing. Certainly keeping the elderly out of nursing homes and figuring out how to take some of that double-digit unemployment that we've got and maybe turn people into healthcare providers, going out and just doing laundry and keeping the elderly comfortable and checking in on them every day to make sure they're okay. Essentially, rent a nephew. Wouldn't it be nice if people could get that kind of a job? And it would certainly be cheaper than the state, our tax dollars at work, paying for nursing homes. Let's go to our next caller, Linda in Monterey. Hello, Linda, and welcome to the show.
I have a 20-year-old son who's living in the mountains. He did a lot of snow shoveling, and then at night he noticed pins and needles in his hand and arm. And then the next day he was carrying skis, and again the tingling and the numbness and pins and needles appeared. And we wanted to know if anything he could be doing besides wearing a wrist guard at night.
Where in his hand are the pins and needles? Do you know exactly which fingers?
No.
Okay. I'm thinking that he may have given himself a nerve entrapment. And there's two places. One is at the wrist. That's called carpal tunnel. And if it's in the wrist, it'll affect the thumb and the index finger.
Okay.
Okay. And the other place is in the elbow. When it's in the elbow, it's from the snap with an axe, which is, and also depending upon your carrying angle, when you straighten out your elbow and carry things, you may pull on the ulnar nerve. And the ulnar nerve goes to the pinky and the ring finger. So if it's carpal tunnel, your pinky is never affected. And if it's ulnar tunnel, cubital tunnel, technically, your thumb is never affected. So when you talk to him, find out which it is. And if it's the pinky, then he wants to ice the elbow. And if it's the thumb, he wants to ice the wrist. And try to get the swelling to go down because he has an overuse injury. And he's squeezing the nerve.
Again, if it's pinky involved, he'll ice the elbow.
Mm-hmm, yes.
If the thumb is involved, he'll ice the wrist.
Right. Okay. And you can have a muscle in the neck that's so tight, it's creating a numbness tingling sensation. And it feels like a pinched nerve without actually having any disc damage. Okay, so it's a little bit scary when you get tingling because you're thinking, oh my God, I've blown out a disc, which is the first thing anybody thinks of under these circumstances. But unless he's having a serious amount of neck pain as well, I think that's extremely unlikely.
Okay, and what about any exercises or being aware of how he snow shovels? Or
there's definitely a way to overdo it, and when you're young and invulnerable, you tend to find that way. So the best thing to do is actually just take breaks and keep the upper body warm. Don't let a draft get on it. Take breaks and just kind of check in and see how you're feeling. Then you can switch sides, for example, and work the other side if you start to feel a little bit sore. But it's kind of take it easy, pace yourself. Don't get into a kind of frenzy. Or if you do, expect to hurt for a few days because you've done something unusual and your body's not accustomed to it, and it's going to tell you about it.
Right. Okay, super.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Don.
You're welcome. If the tingling lasts more than 10 days with the icing, he should see a doctor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Doug in Santa Cruz. Hello, Doug, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I have a problem with my skin. On the back of the neck, I had a little nodule that I went to see a dermatologist, and he told me it was just, a fat pustule.
How big is it?
Originally, it was very, very small. I mean, let's see, what would be a good example?
Think in terms of seeds. We've got peas, we've got garbanzo beans,
It was smaller than a pea. It was more like the size of a seed.
Okay, very small.
You know, there was nothing, no pain or problem or anything.
How big is it now?
It got bigger.
How big?
And it's about the size of a pea now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, swollen up a little bit there. not really red, but it started to itch last night. This started happening over the weekend.
How long has it been there altogether?
I would say it's been there since a good 20 years.
Okay. Is it under the skin, or is there actually...
Yeah, it's under the skin. It's almost like a pimple, you know, but it was like... I went to a dermatologist, and he told me it was a fat pustule.
Mm-hmm.
It was nothing to worry about. Just keep an eye on it.
So it's possible that it's just, a lipoma. I don't call them fat pustules, but lipoma is a fibro-fatty tumor, and they will slowly grow, and we remove them when they hurt or interfere cosmetically, but mostly if they're in a bad spot, they can rub against things underneath and cause problems. If they're not in a bad spot, then it's...
Yeah, it's right on the neck where the collar is.
Right, so it's rubbing and bothering you and becoming irritated. Reason enough to take it out. The other possibility is that it's a sebaceous cyst, and these are filled with a waxy material, but they're actually cysts. And when they're that small, the size of a seed, I would find it impossible to differentiate the two. Once they get to pea size, there's a slight texture difference between the two. So it might be worth going back to a doctor and having a second look, because the cysts can be very easily removed.
Mm-hmm.
A tiny little incision, and you extrude the material and actually turn the cyst inside out. Very easy to do. Solves the problem. If it's a lipoma and you want to remove it, because that's a solid thing, you actually have to open up the skin about 3 times wider. Mm-hmm. So you end up with a scar that's 3 times as long as the largest diameter of your lesion, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't such a big deal, but if it's that long, it's going to need stitches, and of course you'll be buying increased discomfort for the short term. But that being said, if it's in a bad spot, like under the bra line or under the collar line, it might be worth having it removed just for convenience, not because it's suspicious of anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, what a dermatologist says 3 years ago or 10 years ago may have been correct or may not have been correct. And so getting a second opinion, I think, at this point, especially since you're contemplating getting rid of it, would be a good idea.
The thing that I'm concerned about right now is there some infection, because, you know, it's starting to itch a little bit.
If it's infected, it's going to be sore and red, not just itchy.
Uh-huh.
More than likely, it's just gotten some friction and gotten a superficial skin irritation from that.
Right.
Infections are pretty not subtle, let's put it that way.
Okay.
You won't have much question about an infected sebaceous cyst, and I've never seen an infected lipoma. I'm sure they happen, but they're extremely rare.
Yeah, ice seems to be the best thing for it right now.
Yeah, yeah, ice, maybe a little Caladryl or Benadryl cream. You know, cut down on the itching.
Okay.
And then why don't you put a piece of tape over it if you're not allergic, or else a Band-Aid? If you're adhesive allergic, of course, don't do this. But if you put tape over it after your shower, that'll act as a protector.
Uh-huh.
And then your rubbing of your T-shirt collar and the label in the back of your shirt and stuff won't irritate it.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, good. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Happy New Year. And if it's getting worse, of course, go see somebody, all right?
Well, I think on Monday I'll set up an appointment
and then keep protecting it.
Look at it.
Yeah, good idea.
Check it out and see what's going on.
Protect it over the weekend, though.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's go to Garth in Aptos. Hello, Garth, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi, how are you?
Good. They have diagnosed me with hyperthyroidism.
Hyper or hypo?
Hypo.
Po. Okay, go ahead.
And I was just concerned about having to take the medication for the rest of my life.
Well, how old are you?
54.
And did you ever have any radiation to your head and neck, maybe in childhood for allergies? You're the right age for them to have been doing stuff like that?
Not that I remember.
All right. So family history of hypothyroidism at all?
No.
Okay. So there's two possibilities, one of which is you may have a temporary loss of thyroid function from a viral infection, and that will cause a person to test as having an elevated TSH, which is usually, that stands for thyroid stimulating hormone, and that's how we diagnose hypothyroidism, is we measure the signal from the pituitary, and the signal from the pituitary is saying, hey man, make more thyroid. And if that signal is loud, we assume that that's because the thyroid's not responding. That'll last for a month or two and then come back to normal. But it's one of those situations where if it gets picked up by the doctor, they may decide that you have hypothyroidism and tell you you need medicines for life. And that might be true or it might not be true. The other really common one is something called Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And this is actually an autoimmune attack against the thyroid. And The way to differentiate between the two is to measure some antibodies. And the two that I like to use are TPO, which stands for thyroid peroxidase, and antimicrosomal antibody. And if you test for those two in the bloodstream and they're negative, that person I might manage clinically and just follow with the anticipation that their thyroid may bounce back over several months. And if those are positive, then I would take that as presumptive evidence that this person has an autoimmune attack on the thyroid, and I would start supplementing them with thyroid hormone. Generally, once this autoimmune attack is significant enough to impair thyroid functioning, the thyroid functioning does not come back, as a general rule.
I did get a really bad spider bite. They thought it was a brown recluse down in San Diego about 6-7 months ago. It was a really bad infection on my leg, real bad.
You got me. I don't know if there could be a connection. I just don't know.
Yeah.
Good luck. Get those extra tests done.
I will.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, we have a special event here. We have Lyle Troxell, host of Geek Speak, who wants to ask a medical question on the air, sort of getting this combined thing going on.
I guess so. Hey, thanks, Don, for having me.
You're welcome.
So the question had to do with drinking. I heard your great suggestion last week on how not to get a hangover.
Uh-huh.
That's basically make sure to drink fluids, a little bit of salt, a little bit of sugar. You kind of had a tea concoction.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So I was at a party and someone was drinking and they were going to do a shot of something and then they had some wine and they said, oh no, I shouldn't mix my drinks because then I'll have a worse hangover. And I told the suggestion about make sure to do this fluids and all of that. But then I thought, you know, I've heard that a lot from people. I've heard that idea that if you mix different types of alcohols, you're more likely to have a bad hangover. Is there any truth to that at all?
I don't know that anyone's ever done a scientific study, but I'll volunteer.
Get in line, right?
Yeah, really. I don't think they'll have trouble getting subjects. But I think there's some logic to it. And certainly, it goes back to the hepatic detoxification. And I think it's usually the hard liquor cocktail mixes that really do you in.
Now, why is that?
Well, there's more to process. And when you process things, you interfere with the processing of other things. So it's kind of like if you mix Tylenol with alcohol, it's more toxic to the liver.
Mm. So your liver has to figure out how it's going to break down the structures.
And there's competition. There's these enzymes that break down these various components, and they have different affinities for the enzyme systems, and they create these intermediate byproducts, which if there's competition for the secondary transition or the second phase detoxification, it'll slow you down. And I also have to point out there is solute load. So not only do you get the anti-diuretic effect from the alcohol, mm-hmm. but you also get the increased solute load from the juniper berry and in the gin and et cetera, et cetera.
So you're saying there is some other stuff going on in these drinks that are not the alcohol, but your body still has to cope with.
Exactly. And so if you throw a bunch of these things, it impairs your enzymatic process. That plus the dehydration plus having to process the alcohol just intensifies the discombobulation. I'm not sure that's a technical term, but...
Sounds good. So that means that if someone says, oh yeah, I can only do gin, I can't do red wine.
I totally believe them.
Okay.
Yeah, I totally believe them. Just in clinical practice of medicine, we see people who cannot tolerate that antibiotic and they can't tolerate this drug and that drug. And if you actually do testing on their liver, mm-hmm. you can figure out that they have a weak D26 enzyme pathway, and anything that has to go through D26 is going to back up into the bloodstream.
Okay.
So I always listen to that. What I'm waiting for is a nice, quick clinical test that I can order that will tell me, okay, this person's a rapid metabolizer through 3A4 and a slow metabolizer through 2D6.
Wait, what are 3A4 or 2D6? What are those?
These are the cytochrome P450 enzyme systems.
Oh, that cleared everything.
Oh, no. I'll tell you what it does. Okay, but that's what they're called. When you have a substance, your body has to get rid of it. Typically, the way your body wants to get rid of a substance that's dissolved in the blood is to first put a hydroxy, an OH group on it, like a little jump ring on a piece of metal, and then attach something else to it, typically a sulfone or a glucuronidide molecule. And that locks it up so that it doesn't get reabsorbed into the bloodstream. It's called conjugation. So the first step is to make the compound reactive. Mm-hmm. And then the second step is to react something with it that renders it inert and inactive, and then dump it in the bile and poop it out.
Uh-huh.
So it can go through the kidney or it can go through the intestine, but the point is it gets rendered into a form that doesn't recirculate.
Right, because if you put an active thing anywhere in the body, it's going to keep on reacting.
Right. Secondary issue, if you've got the wrong bacteria in your intestine, you can break down that nicely conjugated drug and reabsorb it.
And one of the drugs, Zetia, that they use for lowering cholesterol actually works by preventing the reabsorption of cholesterol from bile. So it messes with that particular function at a point where it is adaptive, that recirculation function. So when you interfere with the processing, the first step, the reactive step, if that's slow, then the drug hangs around longer. The second step, the conjugation, if that's slow, then the secondary metabolite, which is, as you remember I said, highly reactive and can mess around with everything, hangs around longer. Tylenol kills your liver not because the Tylenol is toxic, but because that first transformation when they add the hydroxy group turns it into something that's very toxic to the liver. And if you've got too much Tylenol, as in an overdose, then you can't conjugate it fast enough. And so that reactive intermediate stays around in the liver and destroys cells.
Wow. Great. Well, thank you so much for letting me know how that worked.
And drink sensibly.
Yes, of course. Everyone should. Thank you, Don.
Bye-bye. And don't text while driving, as of the first of the year.
That's right.
Okay. Bye-bye. Let's go to Leslie in Saratoga. Hello, Leslie. Thank you for holding on.
Hi, Dr. Don. I have a question about anal pleasure.
Okay.
I'm not doing too well with vaginal intercourse because of the change of life.
Right. So you've got thinning and dryness and et cetera, right?
Yeah. And I'm having pain at the very end also, all the way in with the penis. So we've been practicing anal intercourse and it's been really wonderful. And there isn't a lot of information on it.
No, and you won't find it online because of all of the difficulties with it starts to be pornography if you discuss anything like this rationally. I want to talk a little bit about AIDS and HIV and assure you that if you're doing this, you and your partner both need to be HIV negative.
Oh, of course.
And he needs also not to have hepatitis B.
Okay,
because these are sexually transmitted diseases and anal sex is just a shortcut to getting them because that organ, you know, the lower intestine, the colon and the anus, is an absorptive surface. It's actually designed to suck moisture and to pull things out of the area. And so it's a very thin membrane and it absorbs well. It's designed for that.
Right.
In contradistinction to the vagina, which is very thick and it's designed to absorb nothing. So if there is something infectious in the sperm, that's a big problem.
Okay.
Microtrauma, micro tears usually occur with anal intercourse.
Okay.
You can kind of expect them. Now, in your case, you're getting tears with vaginal intercourse, too. So your risk is probably equivalent if you substitute. And the reason that you're finding it pleasurable, because a lot of people ask that question. I'm one of the people that people dare ask because it's like I make no judgments. But there's a plexus of nerves in women that's behind the vagina, between the vagina and the rectum. And in fact, it's one of the things that's bad about doing episiotomies is that when you deliver a baby, if you have to do an episiotomy, a big one, you actually cut through that nerve plexus and sometimes you destroy a woman's sexual response.
So, too bad.
So we know anecdotally that in some people that's a very important nervous plexus. So I'm glad it's working for you. The key, I think, is adequate lubrication and proper partner selection.
Right.
And, you know, do understand that really vigorous movement is probably a bad idea, but there have been no reported cases in adults, I want to emphasize, of rupture or complete tearing. That tissue is designed also to really expand a lot. And so what typical male organ is not nearly enough to tear anything. But if you had adhesions, you know, theoretically, really vigorous activity is probably a bad idea.
Okay. How about PC muscles? Do they contract also the anal muscles?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The PC, Kegels, do they contract
all
the musculature down there?
Yeah, they will contract both sphincters.
Okay. Great. Yeah, I just can't find any information on it. And when I asked my doctor if it was okay, she said, if you enjoy it, it's fine.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. What I usually tell people is it's what I just said. You know, it's... There's some physiological reasons why it's not the ideal location, but you can work around those.
Okay, great.
Have a very good day, and thank you for having the courage to ask a question like that on the air.
Oh,
that's great.
I think more people ought to try it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Lisa in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lisa. We've just got a couple of minutes, but I wanted to give you a chance to ask your question.
Thank you, Doctor. I heard the conversation about osteoporosis and the use of strontium.
Strontium, yes.
Thank you. And I'm
wondering if we should be using it with our other anti-osteoporotic stuff, and how much should we use?
All right. I can't tell you off the top of my head how much. 300 milligrams is ringing a bell, but I am not certain of that, so I want to qualify that answer.
All right.
But I believe it's in that ballpark. The studies for strontium were done in Europe, and they were done with a salt of strontium, which is not available in the United States. The strontium that's available here, we do not have direct data that shows that it works. That being said, the strontium itself is the compound that gets incorporated into bones. It's on the same, I believe it's on the same line in the periodic table as calcium. So it is incorporated into bone, and it's denser than calcium because it's molecularly higher up. So it increases bone density, and it would do that even if it didn't increase bone strength. However, it seems to increase bone strength and reduce fractures. The two questions is, you know, does it make my DEXA scan better? Well, that's great. Fluoride makes my DEXA scan better, but fluoride actually makes my bones a little bit more fragile, at least high doses do. And so you can make the scan better and the fracture risk higher. That would be bad. Strontium does seem to do the right thing, make the scan better, and also lower the fracture risk. We're extrapolating when we use strontium that's available here. I don't think it's a bad extrapolation, and I'm sure the data, well, not sure, but I'm pretty confident that the data will come along in a few years that will validate the form of strontium that's available in this country. I know the NIH is looking at that.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too.
Okay. Best way to look at that is there's a beta site called Google Scholar, and you can look, put in strontium and osteoporosis, and you'll get only scientific articles, nothing from anybody who's trying to sell you strontium. So that's one of the useful ways to sort of screen the web for good data, because goodness knows there's a lot of data there that you can't really assess. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. And I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn Motyka saying so long and stay healthy.